Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. On the show today, a conversation with the two newly named chairs of the legislature's Committee on Marijuana Policy. Also, we'll talk about the FCC's move to change some new rules on internet privacy. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Ed Markey isn't having it.
If the Republicans think that they're going to be able to roll back all these protections without a huge fight, they are sadly mistaken.
And a tour of Boston's first and only all-micro-housing building with the design architects who made it happen.
Each of those units has these kitchens that are designed within an inch of their life. And so the kind of design and attention that takes is like a sort of high-end luxury way of thinking.
Plus, Worcester basketball fans and Game of Thrones devotees remember actor Neil Fingleton.
Are we going to stop that?
Shot 20 arrows in him already.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So Google and Apple and countless other internet companies collect your personal data. But if you're an internet service provider, the rules are different. Those companies, such as AT&T and Comcast, have to get user permission before collecting personal data according to federal rules set to go into effect this Thursday. But not so fast. The Federal Communications Commission approved those rules last October, but now the FCC's new chair, Republican Ajit Pai, says those rules favor some companies over others, and he wants to stop them. Pai is getting pushback from Massachusetts Democratic Senator Ed Markey.
If the Republicans think that they're going to be able to roll back all these protections without a huge fight, they are sadly mistaken. This battle is going to be historic, and at the end of the day, the American people are going to want their privacy protected.
Well, let's get a deeper understanding of what exactly is under debate and what's at stake here. Daniel Lyons is an FCC rules and consumer privacy expert. He's also an associate professor at Boston College School of Law, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So first of all, explain to us exactly these FCC rules are supposed to go into effect on Thursday about internet service providers. What do they say?
Yeah, so the story here actually begins with the Federal Trade Commission, which is the entity that regulates consumer privacy in most sectors of the economy. In late 2014, early 2015, the FCC reclassified internet service providers, Comcast, Verizon, companies that provide internet service, as common carriers as part of their mission to adopt net neutrality rules.
I see.
The side effect of that was that it stripped the FTC of jurisdiction to enforce privacy rules because the FTC has no jurisdiction over common carriers. So that left a big hole where there were no privacy rules governing the internet service providers. So the FCC stepped in and adopted a set of rules to fill that gap, but the rules that they adopted were very different than the rules that the FTC applies to the rest of the internet ecosystem.
Okay, so first of all, remind us just briefly, what are the FTC rules on the rest of the internet system regarding privacy?
So the Federal Trade Commission generally operates on what's called an opt-out system. So nobody nobody doubts that privacy is important. The question is how you inform consumers and how consumers can make sure their privacy isn't their information is not used without their permission.
All that small print in the terms of service context.
That's right. The stuff they're required to give you that nobody ever reads, right? So the FTC rules, which govern most of the economy, say that companies that gather your information can use it unless you tell them not to. So it's an opt-out system.
I see.
The Federal Communications Commission adopted a more consumer protective set of rules for internet service providers, saying they can't use your information unless you opt in, unless they get your permission beforehand.
I see. So there's a bureaucratic change then between the FTC and the FCC that prompted these new, more stringent rules on the internet service providers. Okay. So now we have Ajit Pai, the new FCC chair. He actually voted against these rules when the FCC first adopted them last year in October. Why does he have an objection now?
So Chairman Pai, his primary concern is to make sure that we have competitive neutrality in the internet ecosystem, right? So the issue is that Comcast and Verizon and internet service providers are doing the same thing that Google and Facebook are doing, right? Gathering consumer information and then using them in order to sell more targeted advertising. The concern with one set of rules applying to one part of the industry and another set to another is that it makes that competition unfair. So Chairman Pai's goal is to try to adopt the same set of rules throughout the system, and because the FCC's rules are more stringent with regard to some companies than others, he wants to roll those back.
Okay, so do you think he has a point?
I think he does. I think especially if you consider the fact that really this industry, the internet advertising industry, is dominated by Google and Facebook, right? Google's built a multi-billion dollar company off gathering information in order to be able to give you more targeted advertising, which is something that's very valuable to advertisers.
I mean, we were looking at numbers just before the show that said that Google owns some 55% of the ad revenue generated overall on the internet.
I'm actually surprised it's not larger than that. That doesn't surprise me at all.
I mean, I think their quarter four revenue on ads was like $19 billion
well,
just in one quarter last year.
And that's the engine that's funding a large chunk of the services that Google provides for you, right? So it's why when you send an email to your spouse about picking up something at Home Depot, right, you suddenly get a banner ad on the side for Home Depot plywood or whatever.
So you basically see a point in terms of Ajit Pai saying that these rules for the internet service providers sort of put them at a double disadvantage then? I mean, that Google already has such a huge market share and they don't have to ask for your permission.
Yeah, I think the internet service providers were late to this game. They don't gather as much information about you as the internet content providers, companies like Google or Facebook, do. So they don't get as much data to begin with. But then to be told you can't use that data without getting permission, it makes it a lot harder for them to go challenge the incumbents.
Okay, but what about the flip side of things? Like Google knows what you're doing when you use Google products. The internet service providers ostensibly could know what you're doing anywhere on the internet because all the information that you're sending out there is flowing through them.
That's true. So because they control the pipe, right, they have at least eyes on all of the information that's going in and out. It's not actually as different as you might imagine, though. Companies like Google can use cookies and other programs, right, that embed within your computer that not only talk about, not only tell Google what you've looked at when you search Google, but then what pages you go to after that and what happens there too. And the internet, the FTC's privacy rules govern the use of cookies like they do any other information gathering tool.
I see. But it seems as if Senator Markey, for example, is making an argument that there should be a higher level or a higher expectation of privacy applied to the companies that are the gatekeepers for your actual access to the internet.
Well, so curious as to what gatekeeper means, right? To the extent that most of us are going to Google in order to search for information on the internet, right? 75% of all searches worldwide go through the Google search engine. One could build an argument they're also gatekeepers, right? One of Senator Markey. So if Commissioner Pai's concern is leveling the playing field, Senator Markey, I think, is much more concerned about where that level is, right? Is opt out or opt in the right answer?
Right. Well, so I guess, okay, so you asked about the question about what do we think of gatekeepers as? And maybe this is just a sort of a naive interpretation of it, but I'm thinking ostensibly, there are a number of services I could use for search, but in terms of broadband in my home, I mean, it's basically just Comcast, or I don't know, if I wanted DSL, I guess I could use Verizon or Fios maybe, but I don't have that much choice in terms of choosing the company that provides my broadband. So they do have some sort of more powerful or outsized influence in terms of my actual access to the internet.
Sure. And it depends on which device you're using, right? So when you talk about access, when I'm streaming Netflix, I don't have
that many.
I was
thinking wired broadband.
That's right. Wired versus wireless, right? I have multiple choices in how I'm going to access the internet at any point, at least from my place.
Okay. Now, does anybody out there think that maybe instead of applying an opt-out system to these internet service providers, that the United States, the FTC, for example, could adopt FCC-type regulations and ask everyone to move to opt-in?
So former Chairman Wheeler seemed to think that was the right answer overall. His sense was, yeah.
Former FCC chairman.
Yes.
Okay.
So the outgoing FCC chairman. If you read the FCC's rules that it passed last October, it was very clear that the FCC's position was opt-in is the way we should go nationwide. And so they were going to do what they could to move the needle in that direction, which is the model more or less that the EU has adopted.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so that's already what they're doing in the EU. But is that effort kind of dead in the water now?
yes and no. There are good arguments why you might not want to go an opt-in model as well. So a big chunk of the lifeblood of the internet ecosystem, right, runs on consumer information. It's gathering that information that allows Google to give free search and free Gmail and Facebook to support its social media. Anything you do that slows the flow of that information, that hydrant, right, makes it less profitable and therefore makes it harder for companies like Google to offer free services or to experiment with all the different things that their ad revenue is currently funding, like driverless cars.
I just don't see the current political climate in the United States as being very friendly to that idea.
No, I think that's exactly right. I think those who are looking for a heightened sense of privacy are going to have to wait a little while.
Okay. So what is it that FCC Chairman Pai can do? Can he put a stay on these rules so that they don't go into effect on Thursday?
Yeah. So the internet service providers have filed a request for a stay with the FCC pending court challenge of the privacy rules. Commissioner Pai is, or Chairman Pai, is seeking a vote on that to grant the stay pending, and what that would do is effectively arrest the rules so they wouldn't take effect until that court challenge can go forward. And I think this is part of a larger effort by Chairman Pai to roll back these rules and get to a place of competitive balance.
Right. And finally, at the top of the conversation, we played some tape from Senator Markey where he basically described this in, you know, he feels like there's an epic privacy battle going on with these rules and the FCC. I mean, how big of a deal is this?
So at the end of the day, it may not matter all that much, right? Ultimately, if it means the internet service providers have to get a box that you can check when you sign up for service saying you're allowed to use my information, right, then ultimately it won't really matter. The devil's in the details, and the details are not something that the FCC has released as far as I know yet, sort of how you get a consumer to opt in and what level of effort they have to go through in order to get permission from consumers is ultimately really what where the rubber hits the road.
So you said we have an example in Europe. How do they get consumers to opt in there?
So usually it's a matter of getting permission, and my understanding is it's ongoing permission, right? So on every X number of months or years, they have to renew that permission. The real challenge for companies that have an opt-in law applied to them is keeping track of permission, right? So making sure that if somebody challenges them at some point, they have electronic records showing, yes, you gave your permission at this point. And that's not a trivial cost.
Hmm. Well, Daniel Lyons is an associate professor of law at Boston College Law School, and he specializes in the areas of telecommunications and internet regulation. Professor Lyons, thank you so much, and thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that, of course, is Doo-Wop That Thing by hip-hop artist Lauryn Hill from her Grammy-winning 1998 album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. I'll just say it's still one of my all-time favorite albums. But when you think of hip-hop music, the first thing to come to mind probably is not Harvard University. But Harvard has just launched an effort to chronicle hip-hop culture through a music archive, including music from Hill. WBUR's Tanya Mosley has this report on what Harvard is trying to do and why some fans are skeptical.
If you're of a certain age, this sound is definitely a familiar one. It's a needle on a record, and in the world of hip-hop music, it's a signature sound, mixing the old with the new.
What are we listening to?
We listened to Friday the 13th, Cook County Jail, Jimmy McGriff. It's Green Dolphin Street, and it is one of the tracks that was sampled on Tribe Called Quest's Low End Theory.
Peter Lawrence is the senior curatorial assistant at Harvard University's Loeb Library. He's archived hundreds of pieces of music during his 11-year career at Harvard, but this is the first time he's archived hip-hop.
I think it's really great timing here in the music library, looking at bringing many more different types of music into the course of study here.
Right now, you can walk into Harvard's Loeb Music Library and see the album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, right next to scores by Mozart. The curator for this project, music producer Patrick DeWitt, better known as Ninth Wonder, says this display is an acknowledgement of a four-decade-old art form once dismissed by mainstream audiences.
This art form is very misunderstood, and it is very scrutinized by people outside of it that doesn't really understand it. You know, that it's a waste of time, that it's vulgar, that it's misogynist. And I'm thinking, so is America. You know, this is society we live in. You know, hip-hop has just been a megaphone of it.
For 15 years, Harvard has been documenting hip-hop culture at the Hutchins Center on campus. But it wasn't until recently that the university called on producer Ninth Wonder to choose 200 of the most influential hip-hop albums for the Harvard archives. Some hip-hop heads are skeptical. Boston artist and activist Jamal Crawford wonders if Harvard, sometimes known for its highbrow, pent-up reputation, is really serious about chronicling a culture.
I have a level of disdain, or I look at it with suspicion. It's suspect to me.
Ninth Wonder understands the skepticism, but argues the connections between Harvard and hip-hop are really not that far off.
If we're talking about two ideas of genius, you know, or setting the standard, then why can't hip-hop live at Harvard? Why can't it be in a place of genius if it's already genius itself?
Ninth Wonder points to the first four selections of the archive as examples of how serious Harvard is about chronicling hip-hop. Nas's album Illmatic, To Pimp a Butterfly by Kendrick Lamar, A Tribe Called Quest's Low End Theory. If you got the money, Quest is
for the booking. Come on, everybody, let's get... Tribe is the earth, wind, and fire of our culture. They're one of the most important groups of our time.
And
it's funny how money changes situation. Miscommunication lead to complication.
The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. I was on
the
humble, you
on every station. The title itself, Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, came from, of course, people to know, people that don't know. The Miseducation of a Negro.
The Miseducation of the Negro by Carter G. Woodson was first published in 1933 and argued that black people were being culturally indoctrinated rather than taught in American schools.
It spoke truth. It spoke love. It spoke honesty. It tells a complete story. You can't skip a song. And we haven't really seen an album like that since.
Critics like Crawford say he has no issue with the merits of the selections, but rather an overall questioning of the reasoning behind why Harvard has decided to take on hip-hop in the first place. Crawford calls the effort window dressing, a marketing campaign to appear fresh and hip.
It's like McDonald's. We're McDonald's. We, at one point in the 50s, we were, hello, ma'am, would you like a burger today? And then in the 80s, we're like, Big Mac. You see what I'm saying?
Ninth Wonder and his team will archive 10 hip-hop albums a year until they reach 200. Harvard, now joining the ranks of universities like Indiana, Cornell, and UMass Boston, now archiving all that goes into the making of hip-hop music.
A story from WBUR's Tanya Mosley. And we'll head into the break now with A Tribe Called Quest. This is Jazz We've Got from their 1991 album, The Low End Theory. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. But why sweat it? I'm all into my music because that's how I make tapes. Try to make hits like it could remix tapes. Me sweat another. I do my own thing. Strictly hardcore tracks, not a new jack swing. I grew up as a Christian, so did I give thanks. Collect my bank. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Massachusetts continues to try to figure out the best way to implement its new recreational marijuana law. That was after voters approved legalization back in November. And joining us now to discuss some of the key areas under consideration are two newly named chairs of the legislature's Committee on Marijuana Policy. They're joining us today from the State House. We have State Senator Patricia Jalen representing Cambridge, Medford, Somerville, and Winchester. Senator Jalen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you for having us.
It's great to have you. And also with us is Representative Mark Cusack of Braintree. Representative Cusack, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, let me just ask both of you, what does it mean to you, or why is it that you are glad, I'm going to presume you're glad, that you're on the new, the legislature's new Committee on Marijuana Policy? Pat Jalen, let's just start with you.
Well, I think it's a really important job. It's not one I was hoping for because it's a lot of work, and it's not an area I have a lot of expertise in, but I'm getting there. I'm learning a lot every day. It's been a little less than 2 weeks. And we're reading and talking to people every day. So we're trying to learn as much as we can, as fast as we can, to understand what people's concerns are, both in the reasons people proposed the legislation and people who have concerns about it.
Right. And Representative Cusack, did you want this plum assignment?
I did request this assignment. You know, it's a major policy issue. It's a hot button issue. And I do like policy. I've described myself as a nerd when it comes to policy. So I knew this was going to be a very relevant committee and a very important issue and a big policy dive. And that's what I like. So I saw it as an opportunity and a challenge.
Yeah.
And
now,
it's, you know, we've certainly become the popular kids on campus in the last few years.
Well, just let's take a step back here, because Senator Jalin is on the record as having supported question four. Representative Cusack, I'm not quite sure I remember if hearing how you voted on question four. How did you vote?
My ballot is private, and I've maintained that. One of the selling points for me on this is that I'm really open on the issue. I have no position on the issue, and I look forward to getting into the facets of what the voters passed and respecting the will of the voters while making sure that we're putting in common sense, consumer protections, and public safety measures and kind of answering some of the questions that the ballot initiative didn't speak to.
I see. Okay. Now, I fully understand and support the right of every voting citizen to have their ballot remain private. But on the other hand, you were also an elected representative, a state representative. Why not make your vote or your stance, your original stance on question four, public?
Well, I didn't have an original stance. I did vote on the issue, and that's private. My voting record up here on Beacon Hill is public. But I view that, you know, going forward, that I'm going to have a fully open mind regardless of what issue of the law we're looking at. And go from there.
Okay. Well, so let me ask both of you then. Obviously, there is a great deal of controversy right now surrounding the implementation of the law. There are many, many Massachusetts voters who say they voted in favor of question four based on what they read in the ballot question, and that's the law they expect to be implemented. But on the other hand, there's this whole bevy of bills that could make modifications to the law. Do you, Representative and Senator, do you see it as your duty as the members of or the leaders of the marijuana committee to implement the law as written or to be open to these proposed legislative changes?
I think our job is to protect the will of the voters, but also to listen to the concerns that people raise on every side of the issue.
And Representative Cusack?
And I concur. We're not here to rehash or debate whether or not recreational marijuana has a place in Massachusetts. The voters have decided that. What we're here for is really the implementation and the regulation of that market and ensuring, like I said before, the consumer protections, the public safety, that there is adults in the Commonwealth will have access to a regulated and safe market for recreational marijuana.
Mm. I take your point, but I guess what I'm getting at is that there are many people, and Senator Jalin, you said to protect the will of the Massachusetts voters, who say that their will was for the law to be implemented as written in question four, and they just see delay after delay and legislative proposals that would water down the law. So if you're to protect the will of the voters, how does that square with, we've got more than something like 15 different legislative proposals that would change what had been written in question four?
Well, there hasn't been delay after delay. There's been one delay. And I think people have the right to file bills that express their opinion and express their concern, and our job is to listen to everybody and try to make the best decisions we can, while I think, as the representative said, making sure people have what they... I think the basic request of the voters was to make sure that they had access to a safe supply from people who were not trying to sell them something else, to try to kill the black market in a drug that many people use.
And Representative Cusack, your thoughts on that?
Again, just that, there were 5,600 bills filed this session. So the ones affecting marijuana are certainly getting assigned as we speak to our committee. And as the senator said, that's the right of the representatives and senators to file bills to change laws. And, the ballot initiative is a law now, and that's what we're looking at, and that's where we're taking our charge from. But also the average citizen saw it on the ballot, and what they saw on the ballot was a summary. They did not see the 21-page ballot initiative. And so while the proponents who wrote the law or the ballot initiative spent a lot of time and a lot of detail on this, I think there's some unanswered questions and room for improvement while respecting the will of the voters.
Yeah. So just to be clear, I mean, what was on the actual ballot that people voted filled in the bubble was indeed a summary, but they did have access to the full 21 pages of the question in the voters pamphlet. So but Representative Cusack, let me lean on your nerd cred here in terms of policy nerdiness. Where do you see what do you think are priority? What areas of the legalization law are you going to be focused on or your first priority is to take a look at?
Well, the major issues going forward are obviously the tax rate, the regulatory structure. You know, you had everything from homegrown edibles, THC levels. So the whole, you know, across the board, it poses a lot of issues. And, you know, we need to gather the information from the experts and hear from the public and find the balance of the best way to proceed forward to put the best law in place for the Commonwealth and the residents.
Yeah. So do you think that about the tax rate, for example, it's an excise tax of what, 3.75%? Do you think that's too low? I mean, it's the lowest of any state that's legalized marijuana.
It's by far the lowest of any state that has legalized marijuana. But before you get to what, you know, what's the tax rate and how much we're looking to generate here, you really got to decide and look at the regulatory structure and what we need to raise in order to make sure we're protecting the consumers and having a fully regulated and safe market while also making sure we're not overtaxing marijuana so we're sending people back to the black market, the illicit market, where marijuana could be cheaper if we overtax it. So it's really a balancing act in finding that sweet spot between raising enough revenue so we can do our job but also not sending people back to the black market.
Mm. And Senator Jalen, your thoughts on that?
I could not have expressed it better.
Thank you.
Full stop. Okay. So about finding that sweet spot, I mean, I hear you both in terms of like wanting to hear from policy experts, but we do already have some, some on the ground comparisons we can make. Like Colorado taxes marijuana at 29%, Washington 37%, Alaska 25%. Have you heard? I mean, I understand you're still new to the committee because the committee itself is new. But have you heard from any of these states that their rates have forced people back into the black market or not?
I haven't heard that.
I haven't heard that either.
Okay, so it seems like there's a lot of wiggle room then between 3.75 and I don't know 29 or 37% in Washington.
Well, I want to say that I don't consider that the only experiments in the world are in the United States. There are other countries that have had legalized marijuana for quite a while. I would like to learn about how they have, or if they have, been able to destroy the black market.
Mm. So like the Netherlands being the first example that pops into
Yeah, there's several.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Now, what about home growing, right? Because that was the first thing that, I mean, basically as soon as the law passed in December, that was the first aspect of question four that went into effect. It's legal now to grow 6 plants per adult or up to 12 per household. Is that an area that you think deserves further scrutiny?
Well, the other part that went into effect then was also possession and gifting. So those are also legal now.
Those are also legal now? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So do you think that the amount of home growing needs to be scrutinized, or can that just move forward as is?
It'll certainly be looked at. It's one of the avenues. But having it already be legal now, it'll be, you know, we'll take a look at it, but I don't know if it's going to be able to scale back once it's already being, it's, as you said, legal now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a whole other host of issues. You get 6 individually, 12 in a household. Does that mean 12 producing plants? What if you plant 12 and only half of them produce? So it's a whole other, you know, every time you peel one layer here, you find a bunch of others.
Yeah.
So all these issues need a deep dive. And so you get into, not to use a double entendre, but in the weeds on this, and you find a lot more info. So, you know, I don't see a single issue we're going to be dealing with that isn't going to need some debate
I mean, this is a serious issue. It's a major change in Massachusetts, but I always welcome pot puns at the same time. I am here. Being in the weeds is fine with us. Yep. We can have a little bit of levity even in the most serious moments here. But
this is the joint committee.
Oh, here we go. Okay, folks listening, if you want to send us more pot puns, send me a tweet at Radio Boston. But Representative Cusack, you have some experience at the local level in Braintree, and I just wanted to ask you, actually ask you both. There was one real point of contention, which I know many city and town representatives had with question four, and that was they felt that the law doesn't really give them enough options on how to control how many marijuana stores can come into their cities and towns, whether, you know, to what extent they want legalization to happen within their own municipalities. Just your thoughts about that, first of all, Representative Cusack.
Sure. I come from a municipal background in the town of Braintree, and with that municipal background comes a knowledge of zoning and understanding that, you know, while a lot of the cities and towns are upset that they'd have to hold a referendum in order to exclude marijuana, but they have zoning as their best friend. You've seen this with medical marijuana across the state, and one of my towns, I represent Randolph, they've restricted the zoning to one industrial park, and the market is fine with that. In terms of not being able to control the number of stores coming into their town, you know, I think it's set at 20% of what your liquor license is at. So that sounds like a lot in paper, but you still got to understand that this is a marketplace of supply and demand. It doesn't make sense for 20 recreational facilities to open in a town of mine, Braintree. Mm-hmm. They won't survive. So there's also an economic component to that. But we're hearing a lot from the cities and towns, and, you know, big and small, and those are the issues as we get out and listen to the voters, but also the local officials. We're going to be hearing a lot of they want the tools to further regulate, and I don't think one of the issues they want is they don't want to be capped at 2% tax on these locals. They want to be able to negotiate their own mitigation packages as they have been able to with medical marijuana.
Senator Jalen, your thoughts?
I'm listening to people's concerns.
Yeah. Well, we've just got about a minute left here, and there's one last thing I did want to ask you, because there's a big divide between the states that have legalized marijuana and the federal government. I mean, just last week, Sean Spicer, White House press secretary, said that states that have legalized marijuana will see, quote, greater enforcement of federal laws. And of course, Attorney General Jeff Sessions really opposes marijuana legalization. Do you have a concern that Massachusetts, just as we're getting down the road to enacting this new law, could see some backlash from the federal government?
Yes. I think that's a problem. But I think that it's largely a problem for people who want to participate in the business. And so it will be a more risky business.
Hmm. And Representative Cusack?
Yeah, it's a concern. Yeah, we're monitoring it, but, you know, we're proceeding with our work. We're working for the people of Massachusetts on this, and with the administration in place, you hope that the party of state rights respects states' rights, and not just when they feel that they agree with what the states are doing, but across the board.
Well, Representative Mark Cusack and State Senator Patricia Jalen are the new co-chairs of the Committee on Marijuana Policy. They joined us today from the State House. Thank you so very much. We look forward to having you back as things proceed on Beacon Hill. Thanks again.
Well, thank you very much.
How are we going to stop that?
Shot 20 arrows in him already.
Fans will know that of course, is a scene from HBO's Game of Thrones. Well, that roar and those footsteps belong to Mag the Mighty, the enormous mammoth-riding giant draped in bones.
I am the shield! The guards surround the men! I pledge my life and honor to the Night's Watch for this night and all the nights to come!
Mag the Mighty roars no more. Game of Thrones fans know that the giant met his end in season 4 of the show. And this week, sad news that Neil Fingleton, the actor who played Mag, died at his home in England. He was just 36. And whether Fingleton liked it or not, there was another number that defined him.
I'm Neil.
Neil.
Nice
all right,
to meet
Neil.
You.
How tall are you, Neil?
I'm 7'7".
7'7"? Wow. I'm so scared of you, Neil. I can't tell you.
That clip from a BBC show playing up the fact that at 7'7", Fingleton was the tallest man in Britain. But that great height also brought him to Massachusetts, where in the 1990s, Fingleton played high school basketball at Holy Name Central Catholic Junior Senior High in Worcester.
Yes, the rumors you've heard are true. Holy Name sophomore center Neil Fingleton really is 7'5" tall.
Fingleton grew 2 more inches, and in 2002, he played college ball at Holy Cross.
Neil Fingleton, who barely leaves his toes to block that shot into the third row.
Worcester is remembering Fingleton fondly. His former high school coach, J.P. Riccardi, told the Boston Globe that he's a better guy for having known Fingleton. Phil Giarrusso, whom the Globe says acted like a surrogate parent to Fingleton, says the whole city took him in and appreciated his sense of community. Giarrusso said that no one cared Fingleton was tall or that he played basketball. And that come-as-you-are love that Worcester gave him must have been really refreshing to Fingleton, because just about everywhere else he went, people gawked.
Put your camera away. I said, put your camera away. Hey, man, I'm not a clown. I'm not stupid. Don't play stupid. It's rude. It's insulting.
Fingleton told the BBC that it was tough being defined by his height for his entire life. It was a trait completely out of his control.
Being on the front page of The Sun, or being in the Daily Mirror, and being in all these magazines, and TV crews from all over the place wanting to do things on you because you're tall, that's when it really stuck out in my mind, because I'm a 14-year-old lad. I'm trying to fit in with everybody else. A normal 14-year-old isn't going through this, so why do I have to go through it?
Fingleton's time in Worcester propelled him to professional basketball in Europe. He told Holy Cross magazine in 2011 that he never thought basketball would end for him. But it did, following a back injury. That is when he turned to acting.
Every day, how tall are you? How big are your trousers? How big are your shoes? How do you fit in a bed? Over time, you can imagine the consequences that have and who would mold you into being. You could either look at it, why me? But then you could say, why not me? Why not do something special? Why not try and achieve something, because it's my advantage?
And that's the Neil Fingleton that his friends in Worcester are remembering. He was a big guy, former high school teammate Jimmy Moore told the Globe. More importantly, he had the biggest heart. Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If you listen to the show a lot, you'll know that we talk about the Massachusetts housing crunch a lot. And you'll know that we've had a parade of economists on who say that the only long-term solution to bringing those high housing costs under control is to build more. And you'll know that housing experts say that some of those new units should be micro-units. So what would it be like, though, to live in a mere 350 square feet? We recently visited Boston's first and only all-micro-unit housing complex. Can we come in?
Yeah, okay.
The building is on Commonwealth Avenue. It's 180 units, currently leased by Boston University. They're using it as student housing. BU junior Timothy Jennings invites us into his micro unit, which he shares with a roommate. It's about the size of 3 parking spots.
I wouldn't compare this to another apartment, because, you know, most other apartments have, like, the separate bedrooms, stuff like that. But compared to the dorms at BU and everything like that, it's just a bigger space, and then there's just so much in it.
A big part of it is feeling like you're not living in your kitchen.
This is Anda French. She and her sister Jenny designed the micro-housing complex. They're co-owners of the architectural design firm French 2D.
And a big part of a micro-unit is not having an efficiency kitchen, but having it be a real full size that you might actually cook a full meal in. And so a big part of that was, how do you make this feel built in, and how do you have some social spaces so you could have people over? And a lot of that was deciding that we could create really large windows that make the space feel bigger, so when someone comes in, it feels impressive. We could open those up and you could see those. what else? Yeah, so and then the social part of it is important,
you
right?
You know, a large amount of light in each unit and kind of like a, you know, a clockwork watch fitting together all the pieces so that you can imagine where you might transition from cooking to sleeping to, you know, being on a couch or doing your work naturally. So you're sort of collapsing a larger unit into a small space rather than editing out everything and kind of living in a bunk.
So, yeah, being inside this micro unit, I'd agree. It doesn't feel like you're living in a bunk. However, you can bunk the beds. And as we look closer, we see other hidden surprises.
Cool. So, wow, you've got a full-size fridge, a nice little kitchen. I see the bathroom in there in the corner and sort of
a... We're going to open the little closet there. We've got laundry in there, so...
Oh, yeah. Wow, you got. Does every unit have a washer dryer?
Yes. Nice and convenient.
Wow, okay, that's great.
Obviously, I'm totally jazzed by the in-unit laundry. Definitely not something I had when I lived in a studio umpteen years ago. But all of a sudden, that makes me wonder. Honestly, what is the difference between the two? Cynical Gen Xer that I am, I ask, is a micro-unit just a studio polished up with 21st century rebranding?
The studio already has a certain stigma. You're going to have this efficiency kitchen. You're going to be kind of, when I lived in New York, right, we're going to sneak back to our apartment like late at night because I've gone to all the restaurants and I've had my life outside. And the hope here is that by creating some amenities that feel like a full-size house, that you're not editing out those parts of your life. You're actually just being more efficient and shrinking it down, but still living it fully here.
That. No, it makes perfect sense. I mean, I have fond memories of my little studio, but its kitchen was a postage stamp size. I had a toy oven and just a refrigerator, no freezer, like one of those half galley refrigerators. That was it. We cooked a lot of great meals. but still, it did not have this feel of a completely a full-fledged housing unit. It just didn't.
And maybe part of that is you probably couldn't imagine yourself going back and living there now.
Definitely
not. Right? But the hope is that a micro unit might be really good for an empty nester and that they might want to live in this way because it doesn't feel like I've now gone back to like my provisional life of when I was in my 20s, which was fun, but you know, you have this kind of other way of imagining
life. It's not a kind of real estate demotion, hopefully, and that is what, you know, the finish is and a little bit of a sleeker, brighter design, you know, would like to achieve. I honestly think it has to do with a kind of social and sustainable narrative about bringing density to cities and allowing access to more desirable locations for a greater amount of the population. And also kind of a you know, treating people, like allowing people to live smaller and maybe more minimally, but then experience hopefully a richer social or cultural life.
I think a lot of it, too, is there's a sustainable model behind it, which says, let's own less stuff, let's have more experiences. And this, we hoped to make the design such that when you're in that space, it doesn't feel like a dorm. It feels like a beautiful, light and airy space that might be larger, but because it isn't, you're going to come out into the city and be part of it, or you're going to come out into the building, into the open spaces.
Packing a complete living experience into 180 tiny units posed some design challenges. Not just aesthetic ones, though the French sisters also added high-end finishes to really offset the small feel, but even the basic construction of the building required a complete rethink. Everything from how to wire the lights to building the walls. Anda and Jenny point to a piece of trim right above our heads.
Where those two pieces of trim come together, that took like 15 people in this room making sure that that was going to work.
But explain to me why. So you have the trim for the bathroom door mm-hmm. and then for the closet where the washer dryer is mm-hmm. meeting in the corner. So I would have never noticed that. What's the problem
it
there?
Seems crazy. Yeah. So to the contractor, this seemed totally out of the ordinary and crazy because they had to build out the frame here for the door so that the face of that washer dryer fit precisely into this space and then that the trim could meet at that corner also for them seemed so unorthodox that we needed to stand here and draw it because usually you would just have an opening and you'd throw the trim around it. And
so there were some small hacks to get things to fit together and, you know, a lot of sketches to really get regular materials to do a little bit more custom work here.
Did you have contractors who were like, this is crazy?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And a really good example of that is each of those units has these kitchens that are designed within an inch of their life. And so the kind of design and attention that that takes is like a sort of high-end luxury way of thinking. And this building was being built by a very, like, a good contractor who thought of it as this is more like a dorm or studios. And so they would look at us like, you're just being difficult. You think that 4 inches matters? It doesn't. And we would say, but it matters because the person living there can't go to IKEA and buy a desk that's going to fit there if you take away those 4 inches. And so we had a lot of fights like that. And part of it is we're two young women, not that young, we're two women on a job site convincing people who have done this 1,000 times but in a totally different context that these are really important issues in this building. And from their experience, they're not. You know, if you lose 4 inches in a 2-bedroom condo, no one's ever going to notice. But if you lose it here, you change everything.
And therein lies one of the ironies of Boston's micro-unit experiment. Remember how Jenny and Anda said that part of the appeal is by living small, you're living more sustainably? However, sustainable does not mean cheap. Right now, micro-units are very expensive to build.
When you look at the price tag that's per square foot, someone is expecting a 100,000 square foot building to cost a certain amount per square foot. You're not thinking about that metric when you're putting a kitchen every 10 feet instead of every 30 to 40 feet because you've got more apartments. So the building was already going to cost more because that's where the real infrastructure is, the kitchens and the bathrooms. So then we had to do a lot of creative work to keep the finishes looking really nice, but keep those costs down. And then there are other structural things where we had to make it, it's all out of wood. So that's a big piece of the puzzle of kind of keeping it in a range that you can afford all the infrastructure.
So how do I phrase this? Ultimately, did the developer or the owner, are they making money off of this?
Yes. And I think the master lease piece of the puzzle is really an incredible incentive for developers. So in order to build these, the bridge, of course, is when you first build it and then you have to rent it out unit by unit. So 180 units might take a full year to do a full rent out. But by having BU do a master lease for 2 years, it allows them to ramp up marketing earlier while it's still occupied. And so I think for them, that's a really good deal.
Is it possible that a developer would achieve more per square foot with micro units than with typical new construction?
I think it's yet to be seen. I think the potential is there, and developers in the area are very interested in the market for exactly that reason. So it is really, it's the problem of you know, the social motivation and the sustainable narrative and capitalism.
Yeah.
All this.
Well, because I mean, I'm asking that because I laud the aspiration and the ideas, but there's also the economic realities, and there's always this concern about whether, if that does indeed happen, would we actually end up with higher rents?
That's a very interesting question. We talk about this a lot, and that is purely the volume issue, and it has to be in a larger scale. Otherwise, the market will always drive it up because the demand is always here. So as architects, we're like 1 or 2 degrees away from that, and it makes it very hard for us because our aspirations then have to match up to whatever that economic plan is, which is always shifting.
As we mentioned earlier, this micro-unit development is currently leased by Boston University. That lease expires next year, and that is when the real viability test for micro-housing in Boston begins, because the owner hopes to convert the building to market-rate rental apartments aimed at young professionals. So we asked Timothy Jennings, the BU undergrad who's currently living in one of the micro-units, hey, you're going to be a young professional someday. So
if you had to pay rent on a place like this, how much do you think you'd be willing to pay?
It's a good question. I don't know.
Okay, so what would market rate be for a unit like this?
It was planned at $1,800 a month.
$1,800. He just went, whoa.
We need about 1,000 more of them to pull that down. That's part of it. Right? Or 50,000 more, as the mayor says.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's Boston, right? So 1800 is the price point for, okay, the hoped for price point.
That was the design.
The design, okay.
The thing is, the market is pushing that a lot. So the similar size in the Seaport, of course, it's the Seaport, is getting $2,700 a month for the same size. So what are you studying again?
Biochem.
Okay, you're
He's going to med school.
He'll be okay. Yeah.
Small faces.
So we trust that someday Mr. Jennings will be just fine with his med school degree. Jenny and Anda French of architectural design firm of the design firm French 2D. They designed Boston's first and currently only all micro unit housing complex. It's on Commonwealth Avenue on the BU campus. Now, if you want to see what modern living in 350 square feet looks and feels like, you can. There is a version called the Urban Housing Unit, or UHU, currently in the Seaport, and you can visit it. We've got some more information on where it's located and how you can visit it at radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.